Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 20th of September. Yesterday morning, the president outlined his deficit reduction plan, calling for $1.5 trillion in new taxes. He vowed to veto any deficit reduction package that cuts benefits to Medicare and Medicaid recipients, but doesn't raise taxes on the wealthy and big corporations. He said the money has to come from someplace if we're not willing to ask those who've done extraordinarily well to help America close the deficit. The math says everybody else has to do a whole lot more. We've got to put the entire burden on the middle class and the poor. The president called for a millionaire's tax a month after Warren Buffett said that he and his mega-rich friends pay a significantly lower percentage of their income in federal taxes, income and payroll taxes, than everyone else. Before the plan was announced, the House Budget Committee Chair Paul Ryan said of the plan and the president, he's in a political class warfare mode and campaign mode, and that's not good for our country. Raising taxes on the wealthy would discourage investment, according to those who are upset about this plan. And we are going to be talking about it this hour. We're going to have a lot of phone calls this hour. I can just feel it. We have two guests who have very different opinions. James Joyner has been managing editor of the Atlantic Council for a number of years. He wrote a piece saying that Republicans will decry this as class warfare. For once, they'll be right. The sole purpose of this proposal, which has zero chance of being passed into law, is to leverage resentment against the most successful for political advantage. Later, former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich will be joining us. He says so much money is now concentrated at the top of what we really need are more tax brackets at the high end, higher marginal rates in each bracket, and a tax code that treats all sources of income, whether ordinary or capital gains, the same. What do you think? Here's our phone number. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. James Joyner has been managing editor of the Atlantic Council for 3 years now, 4 years now, and editor of the popular blog Outside the Beltway. He has done a great deal of writing for The Atlantic, Foreign Policy, The National Interest, World Politics Review, CNN, Politico, Reason, Legal Affairs, and the list goes on. He was managing editor of Strategic Insights, the professional journal of the Center for Contemporary Conflict at the Naval Postgraduate School. He worked 2 years as a management analyst at Landmark Technology. And he served in the U.S. Army from 1988 to 1992 and is a combat veteran of Operation Desert Storm. He was awarded the Bronze Star Medal. He has a Ph.D. in political science from the University of Alabama. James, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Do you think that the president is, as Congressman Paul Ryan said, in a campaign mode now, knowing that there's no chance of this getting through? He just needs a platform for reelection?
Oh, I don't think there's much doubt about that. I'm not arguing that he doesn't actually believe in the policy he's proposing, but I think that, one, he knows it's not going to happen, just given the environment. He's not going to get anything close to what he's asking for. And the way he's rolling it out, the language he's using, I think is clearly, you know, political. It is aimed at, you know, stoking class resentment rather than, you know, persuading people to his argument.
The people who are in favor of this will say that there is absolutely no way to do any kind of significant deficit reduction unless you increase revenue.
Oh, I actually agree with that. I don't know exactly what the plan is in terms of how he wants to do what he what he, you know, in terms of raising the revenues. You know, how he wants to, you know, make, you know, the Warren Buffett types pay more revenue. You know, if it is in fact a millionaire's tax, and, you know, basically, you know, sort of a new version of the alternative minimum tax, where it's like, well, you made this much money, we don't care about your deductions, you know, here's your penalty, I think that would be something I would certainly would object to. On the other hand, what he's talking about is simply, hey, look, you know, there are certain types of people, and Warren Buffett is, you know, is obviously the exemplar of this, who make a whole lot of money, and because of the way the tax code is written, they don't pay a very high percentage of their income because we treat investments differently. We have this carried interest rule, some other things. If you know, we're talking simply about reforming those things, I think that's fine. But you know, over there was a pretty interesting AP fact check that came out this morning. People who or households that bring in over $1 million a year, in fact, do pay a much higher percentage of their income to the federal government in taxes, and that includes payroll taxes as well as income taxes. They pay on average of over 29%, and it goes down very progressively from there, so that the people at the bottom pay next to nothing. Those making $20,000 to $30,000 pay 5.7%. So we don't have a problem per se with millionaires not paying their fair share. Millionaires, in fact, pay a whole lot of money to the federal treasury. What we have is a problem with we're treating different classes of income differently.
Robert Reich, who will be on after you, we wanted to have a chance for each of you to say things rather than have a debate about this. But he will talk about historically what the tax rates have been in this country and make mention of the fact that the first three decades after World War II, before Ronald Reagan changed the tax rate, the highest marginal tax rate was over 70% in this country.
It was actually over 90%. Yeah, it was in the 90, 91, 92% for basically from the onset of World War II and to like the Eisenhower administration. John Kennedy initiated a lowering of the top marginal rate that went into effect during the Johnson administration, took it into the 70s, and actually well into Ronald Reagan's term, the top marginal rate was 50%.
And
the levels where we've got now are pretty low historically. You have to go back basically to really before World War II to have sort of comparably low rates.
And did the economy suffer as a result of those high rates?
I think so. I think that there's sort of two issues. One is what the rate is and how large a percentage of people pay it. We've only had an income tax in this country, actually a little less than 100 years. Where I guess in 2013 we'll hit the 100th anniversary of it. And initially, the income tax was a very, very low. I think it was 7%. I'd have to go look at the charts. But it impacted very, very few people. People who would be the equivalent of making multi-millions of dollars of income in today's dollars. It was a very small percentage of people paying a fairly negligible by today's standards amount of their income. And that sort of skyrocketed with World War I and then again with World War II. But what has also happened is that we had more brackets, and we've sort of gone back and forth with the number of brackets we have. But we've spread it out so that now roughly half of Americans effectively pay income taxes. Most people in the lower end think they're paying taxes because we withhold money, but when they file at the end of the year, they get it. They get it back.
When you talk about a plan that would be, something that everybody could live with that would be okay as a source of increasing revenue, what kind of plan are you envisioning?
Well, I mean, my druthers, which is not politically possible, is basically to scrap taxes on income entirely and tax consumption instead, so that you're doing it in a way where you're charging people for living extravagantly rather than making money and having accounting gimmicks and lobbying for loopholes and that sort of thing. Given that that's not possible, I think what you do is probably sort of a combination of things. I think you eliminate a lot of the deductions, some of which made sense at a given time and it sort of outlived their purpose. I think you probably let the Bush tax cuts expire, so that you go back to slightly higher. I think go from 35% to 38 point whatever it was. That actually brings in a substantial amount of money. There's sort of two other issues that, in terms of progressivity in the code, one is while. Again, roughly half of the country doesn't pay federal income tax at all. pretty much everybody pays into, you know, Social Security, the FICA or payroll tax. It goes by different names. And what we've done with the payroll tax is we cap it. It's like $106,000 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Once you reach that level, you no longer pay into it. So you sort of get an effective tax cut at that level. And that makes sense if you conceive of Social Security as an retirement investment account, because we also cap payouts. It's like, you know, $2,400 a month or something like that is the most you can make on Social Security. So that creates some distortions in sort of the middle range, you know, where people are, you know, at low levels are actually paying a higher rate of their income into the federal government because of that. So you could change that, but then I think you change the nature of the argument on Social Security. It becomes essentially a welfare system rather than a retirement fund.
Yeah, it seems to me as though it might be hard to sell that, because that was one of the reasons that it was sold, that it was...
Oh, that's exactly right. And it's always been sort of largely mythological, you know, that it was in fact a way of, you know, of making people who were otherwise reluctant to take any money from the federal government. It's like, oh, no, you're entitled to it. You've paid for this. This is an investment. And it's really not, but, you know... It's sort of how we've sold it. The other issue, and again, it affects a relatively small number of people in a major way, is, you know, how do we treat investment income? And I don't really have the answers to that. It's sort of, you know, outside of my area of expertise, but it makes sense on one level that, you know, for most of us who put money in the stock market via, you know, mutual funds, you know, put money into a retirement fund, you take a small percentage of your income, you invest it over time. Well, it would be pretty silly to treat, you know, the capital gains on that as ordinary income, because, you know, one, you've lose money on it over time. You know, you'd have to account for inflation. But also there's the factor of risk. Yeah, that money, as many of us have found out a couple of years ago, you know, it can come down pretty precipitously. And if you happen to, you know, be needing the money, you know, at that point, you know, you can be in trouble. So it doesn't make sense to treat the two, you know, the same for ordinary folks. The problem is if you're a Warren Buffett, for all intent and purposes, this is your job. You know, the money he's making investing and breaking up companies and selling off pieces of companies and so forth, you know, that is effectively his you know, his salary. And we treat it differently, you know, under the tax code. And maybe that's, you know, we've had to figure out, I think, a way to balance those things out.
What you just outlined would be amenable to Republican leadership or not?
Probably not. I mean, the problem is that, I mean, the Grover Norquist wing has sort of taken over, and it's almost sort of at a theological level. I mean, I voted for every Republican president or nominee, you know, since I've been eligible to vote, but the tide has sort of turned. You know, the arguments, you know, it makes sense, you know, if, as in 1980 when Ronald Reagan took office, that, you know, the top marginal rate is 70%, you know, it makes sense to say, look, we need to bring this down because what you're doing is discouraging people from working, from, you know, from taking risks, because it's such a, you know, huge chunk. You know, what's the point if all you get to keep is 30% of it? But if that, you know, and so there's a so-called Laffer curve, you know, it sort of shows that you can make, you know, actually take in, you know, more revenues to the government by cutting taxes. Well, that's true, but what people sort of forget is that the Laffer curve actually curves. So, you know, I mean, obviously, if your tax rate is zero, you're not going to bring in any money. You know, if you tax it 100%, you're not going to bring in any money. So, you know, there's an equilibrium. And, you know, I don't know where that is exactly, and it probably changes, but, you know, I don't think that, you know, the argument between, you know, 35% and 38%, you know, is going to be a huge change one way or the other in terms of productivity.
James Joyner, our guest, the first half hour, we'll be going to your phone calls momentarily at 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Second part of this hour, former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich will be joining us. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour number two of our program, Jim Lehrer will be joining us. Tension City is his latest book, Inside the Presidential Debates, from Kennedy Nixon to Obama McCain. He is considered one of the most respected journalists in broadcast journalism, and he has moderated 11 presidential debates and interviewed every U.S. president since Gerald Ford. This book is a behind-the-scenes look at what it's like to go through those debates, how the preparation takes place, the rules for the debate, who's on the panel, and some of the things that go wrong. Plus, he asked all of the participants to give their reflections on what was said at their particular debate. So it's a fascinating book, and he's a great guy. He'll be with us, hour number two of our show. All right, let's go to phone calls. Joe in Franklin, our first caller for you, James. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Kathleen. Great to talk to you. I just want to give, I agree, our federal income tax system right now is ridiculous, and here's an example. Last year, my wife and I, now I'm retired, she's still working, we made a little under $85,000. We paid just about $9,000 in federal income tax. I have a son who's a teacher at a small private high school here in Wisconsin. He made around $33,000. He paid about $4,000 in federal income tax. I have a brother who's worth over $9 million. Last year, his wealth increased by about $700,000. He, through investing in tax-free municipal bonds, deferred capital gains, paid nothing in federal income tax.
Really?
Yes, yes. I mean, this is just ridiculous. Now, I agree, we should let all the Bush tax cuts expire. I don't think any type of consumer, which is basically a sales tax, and is going to hit the poor the hardest. I don't want to go along with that. But, I mean, what does your guest have to say about a system like this?
James.
Yeah, I mean, it is strange. And I'm not by no means an expert in tax law. I mean, I do security policy for a living. But, you know, it is a strange system. I mean, we don't tax wealth at all very well. We tax income. And, you know, as Joe says, there's a lot of things you can do with income. There are certain kinds of income that, if you've got, a tax-free municipal bond, that's, government is basically giving you a really strong incentive to loan it money, right? Municipalities have trouble raising taxes, so bonds are usually their preferred method, if it's tax-free, it's tax-free. It makes sense for them, but it's not great from an equity standpoint.
Thank you, Joe, very much for the call. Rob and Nina, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
All right.
Small businesses will benefit from this tax relief that Obama's doing. And you can look at Kraft Company in Appleton, and they don't pay any taxes at all, and they were given a huge tax break for setting up their businesses in Wisconsin. And I just think that the Republicans are just selfish pigs.
All right, let's go to an email from Roxanne in Green Bay. To say this, and I'd like to, we hear a lot of this, that this is a job-killing plan that in order to make investments in the economy, you can't increase the taxes on the wealthy. To say this plan is job-killing is just more conservative rhetoric. The super-rich, the job creators, as the Republicans call them, have had ample opportunity to create jobs in this country for many years. They haven't followed through. They have had tax incentives, loopholes, and breaks, and have only padded their pockets at the expense of the middle class. To say it's punishing to ask them to pay more is to suggest it is more appropriate to punish the poor because they're not rich. This bill should be passed and built upon, not shut down. What do you say, Jim? James?
Well, I mean, it's. I think it was a sort of separate argument. I mean, you know, whether you tax, you know, Warren Buffett on investment income, you know, how you do it. I mean, I think it'll, it may, you know, at the margins affect, you know, his hiring practices. Yeah, our corporate tax structure is sort of a different animal entirely, and it sort of speaks to, you know, problems with our whole tax code. I mean, on the one hand, we've got, you know, some of the highest nominal rates on the planet for corporate. A lot of societies don't even tax corporations at all. We have like a 35% rate, which is, again, one of the highest. But there are so many loopholes and deductions that have been carved out that, you know, a lot of companies pay, you know, effectively no taxes. And some of that's accounting gimmickry. It's you shift income from one year to another year, and, you know, and so they have wild fluctuations in their tax rates. But it's a strange system that we've created. But we've politicized it, right? It's you know, we've tried to do multiple things with our tax systems. I mean, you know, most obviously we're trying to raise revenue, but we're also using it to incentivize certain behavior. So, you know, which is why we have various, you know, deductions for, you know, for sending your kids to school. You get deductions for having extra kids, for, you know, investing and buying a house and so forth. But you know, people who are well organized and well connected, and, you know, and lobby can rate into the tax code all sorts of exceptions, and it creates just sort of a mishmash, and it's an ever changing system. So you also, on top of, you know, of all that, you create this sort of a cottage industry of sort of gaming the tax system.
Peter in Stoughton, hi.
Morning. To follow up on what your guest just said, we have General Electric, which essentially paid no corporate income taxes last year. They have their medical division here in Wisconsin, and in fact worked for a company that also did work for the GE medical division. Now they're expanding in China. Now you would like to think that they would be keeping their design and engineering component here and enlarging that here in the U.S., but no, they're moving that division over to China.
James.
No, I mean, that's right. It's, I mean, again, a separate issue from, you know, individual income taxes, but we live in a global economy, and what, you know, what that means is that there is a really strong incentive to both shift revenues so that you're taxed at the places that'll tax you the lowest, and to, you know, use as much cheap foreign labor as you can, as opposed to, you know, relatively expensive, you know Western labor, and that creates a race to the bottom. I don't know how to stop that race, though. I think it's just a fact of life of a global economy. I think you could probably structure the tax system a little bit to incentivize, domestic investment to make it harder to shift profits overseas. But I think it's a very hard thing to do.
Finally, for you, just a question of where Republicans go with this in terms of formulating their strategy, given the fact that a majority of Americans really believe that tax, that revenue needs to increase along with cutting spending on programs, when you have John Boehner saying tax increases are not a viable option. Are the Republicans going to have to give on this just for them to have stronger campaigns in 2012?
I don't think they're going to give in between now and 2012, no. I mean, I think over time there's not much choice but to give, because that which is, is unsustainable won't be sustained. But no, I think in the short term, the Republicans have calculated that, basically taking a very hard line on revenues and, insisting on austerity through spending is the right strategy. And it has worked for them, so far. It worked for them in 2010. It's, we'll see what's happening. It's worked for them in a couple of special elections since. We'll see what happens, next cycle. But, yeah, I don't think there's going to be any give anytime soon.
James, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, absolutely.
James Joyner, managing editor of the Atlantic Council, editor of Outside the Beltway. We continue our conversation on the president's remarks yesterday, his outline for, although it wasn't real complete, his broad outline of a deficit reduction plan, which called for $1.5 trillion in new taxes. Robert Reich is going to be joining us now, former Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration. He is a professor now, Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley. He has served in three national administrations and has written a number of books, including The Work of Nations, Locked in the Cabinet, Supercapitalism, and his most recent book is Aftershock. You can also hear his marketplace commentaries on publicradio.com. We'll continue phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. He, of course, has written on Sunday, September 18, Taxing the Rich the Obama Way, in which he says, when the president refers to his new initiative to raise taxes on millionaires as the Buffett rule, we might expect he'd start the bargaining from a tough position. But this is Barack Obama, whose idea of negotiating is to give away half the house before he's even asked the other side for the bathroom sink. He gives some really interesting information in his column about what's happened over the last, you know, three decades, if not longer, to tax codes in this country, what's happened with wealth concentration in this country. And we're very happy to have him on the air with us. Secretary Reich, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm just great. Well, good to talk to you.
Good. And you're up so early, too, and you sound so chipper.
Well, it's not that early. I mean, we are in California, but we're still, you know, part of the United States here. Some would say not, but we are still, it's not all that early.
Yeah. Well, okay. And you definitely are part of the United States. You are definitely part of the United States. When you heard the president outline his kind of vague plan here, did you say to yourself, I'm glad you finally stepped up to the plate, or this is too little too late?
Well, I thought it was too little. That is, if the president is going to make a big stand on improving the tax code and also expecting the rich to pay their fair share, I would have hoped that he would have actually called for increasing the number of brackets at the very top and raising the actual rates at the very top and making the capital gains rate equal to the ordinary income rate. You see, these are, to me, very fundamental moves with regard to tax reform. The very rich in this country now, they take home roughly about 20% of total national income. And that is double what they took home. That is, the proportion of income they took home in the 1970s was about 9 to 10%. And the rich keep on getting richer, which is not a problem for them. In fact, ordinarily it's not a problem at all. But we're not in ordinary times. And if the rich don't pay their fair share, we are going to find the middle class and the working class burdened with higher taxes and fewer public services.
What, how did the rich get so much richer?
Well, that's a good question. My analysis shows that during the 19, and this has been going on, the trend has been happening since the late 70s and early 1980s, and we're talking about pre-tax earnings. What's happened is that globalization and technological change have both made such an impact on the American workforce and on the American economy that if you are very well educated, if you are very well situated, if you are a problem solver, a problem identifier, if you're very well connected, and have really made the right moves, that you're at the head of a big company, you're the CEO of a major corporation, you're on Wall Street, chances are you are going to be earning a huge amount because globalization and technology are working on your behalf. And on the other hand, Kathleen, if you are an average worker who doesn't have all these advantages and also who is not all that well connected and who is not all that lucky, globalization and technology are working in the opposite direction. They have undermined your wages, undermined your benefits, and made your life more and more precarious.
It seems to me as though there is some issue of fairness. I must tell the audience, they probably know this, that we are state workers here at Public Radio, and that, as you well know, Secretary Reich, state workers in the state of Wisconsin have seen salary decreases, you know, almost 8 to 10% as a result of paying a whole lot more for pension and for benefits, which, you know, is a separate kind of issue because how much more money do we have to contribute to the economy? But if things are so bad that public employees are being asked to contribute quite a bit for their benefits, then why wouldn't it be fair to ask those people who have really benefited from good times to pay a little bit more money? I mean, and most people would agree with that.
Well, as you know, it's not just public employees, obviously, Kathleen. I mean, the median wage, the typical wage of the typical worker in the United States continues to drop if you adjust for inflation. And that's been going on since at least 2001. And for the last 30 years, the typical wage of hourly workers, that is 80% of the workforce who are working for an hourly wage, that typical wage has been going down as well, adjusted for inflation. Meanwhile, people at the top have been doing better and better and better. You know, the typical chief executive officer of a big company, while 30 years ago was earning about 30 times what the typical worker was earning, now is earning over 300 times what the typical worker is earning. And to make matters even worse, at least worse from the standpoint of the debt and the contribution that the rich are making, the taxes, the tax rate that the people at the top are paying keeps on going down. It's now half. 35% is our top marginal tax rate in this country right now. In the before 1981, it was at least 70%. And capital gains, which are, you know, increases in the value of assets, the taxes on capital gains, which the very super rich pay. They're down to 15%.
Oh my!
And they were down. They were up to 35% in the 1980s. So, if you look at every dimension of this, what you see is that while most Americans are more insecure, having lower wages, fewer benefits, paying higher taxes, if you consider payroll taxes and sales taxes, that certainly is taking a bigger bite out of the paychecks of most people than anything at any time before. What you see at the same time is the very, very rich in this country are richer than they've ever been, taking home a higher percentage of total income, paying lower taxes at a lower tax rate, and basically exercising more political clout than ever before. Well, under these circumstances, it would be bad enough, but we are in a crisis of jobs, growth, and we have a debt to pay off, and I just don't think it should be a matter of debate to say that the rich should pay and sacrifice a little bit more when so many of us who have so much less ability to sacrifice are sacrificing so much.
You said in your piece the marginal tax rate ought to be raised to 50% on income between $500,000 and $5 million, 60% on income between $5 million and $15 million, and 70% on income over $15 million. If that, not that it stands a chance at all, but if that should miraculously pass, how would we be better off? How would things change?
Well, for one thing, we would have a lot more money to reduce the debt and the deficit that the rest of us would not have to pay. We wouldn't have to sacrifice Medicare. We wouldn't have to sacrifice education, at least the federal contribution to education, or infrastructure spending. We wouldn't have to make as many sacrifices as we, the rest of the country, would have to make. If we had those kinds of marginal tax rates, which are comparable to what we had in the 1950s, 60s, and 1970s, we would probably be, and again, this is my figuring on the back of an envelope, so I think that it's probably right, at least it's within the right magnitude, be getting about $350 billion a year more from the very wealthy and the super rich than they now contribute. And that would help enormously, Kathleen. Again, this is a matter not just of economics. It's also a matter of fairness. It's a matter of just public morality. And for those who say as they inevitably will say and have said, that the rich create the jobs, and if you tax them more, you're going to be reducing job growth. My response back is that the most of the rich are CEOs, Wall Street types, people who have very, very big companies, top executives in big companies. They're not creating jobs. They continue to lay people off. The job creators are small business owners, and only about 1.5% of small business owners are in the top income tax bracket, as it is today. I mean, there's no argument, there's no good argument for why we are not raising taxes on the very rich.
Could you, before we go to phone calls, talk about that? And I don't know the exact number, but it's something like $2 trillion in cash that some companies, large companies, are holding on to, and I don't understand why.
Well, they're holding on to it because they obviously don't see any way of investing it that's going to generate a big return for their bottom line, for their shareholders, and that is obviously their primary responsibility. But what it means is that by offering, as Republicans and others are saying, tax breaks to corporations, we're not going to see more jobs. I mean, if they're sitting on $2 trillion already that they're not investing, if the ratio, as it is today, of corporate profits to wages is higher than it's been at any time since before the Great Depression, corporations, it's not that corporations need more money in order to create jobs. They're not creating jobs because they don't have enough customers. And the reason they don't have enough customers is because most consumers, because consumers are, after all, workers, are still bearing a huge debt load. Their housing values have dropped 33% since 2006, and people are scared. This is why they're not buying. We're in a vicious cycle in which businesses are not creating jobs because consumers aren't buying, because businesses, again, are laying people off. That vicious cycle can only be broken if the spender of last resort, and that is the government, steps up to the plate, and in the short term, does spend more on creating jobs, infrastructure jobs, education jobs, help the states create. Now, many of these things the president did call for in his jobs bill last week. But here again, I would have hoped he'd be a little bit more ambitious. And in saying this, Kathleen, I don't mean to criticize the president. I think he's moving in the right direction. But given that Republicans are going to say no anyway, why not be sufficiently large and bold relative to the size of the problem, and then take it to the country and run on it?
Yeah. Well, he could always say we need to invest in roads all over this country so those of you who have a lot can drive your Lexus.
Right. But he can also say, and this is absolutely true, that people at the top would do better with a smaller share of a rapidly growing economy than they're doing now with a much larger share of an economy that's dead in the water.
Interesting.
It's not a zero-sum game. It's not as if by taxing the rich, everybody else does better and the rich do worse. No, if you tax the rich, if you then invest that money in education and roads and bridges and more jobs for people, the economy starts growing again, and even the very rich do better, ultimately. And we also have the wherewithal to reduce the long-term debt.
Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration, Robert Reich, our guest, Robin in Middleton. Hi.
Hi. I find it extremely annoying with how taxes work these days. I feel like nobody cares about the poor and middle class. I work full-time night shifts all throughout the week and go to school all day full-time, and I only make like $18,000 a year, and I had to pay into taxes last year, and it's just obnoxious.
Secretary Rush.
Well, Robin, not only is it obnoxious, but you're also paying payroll taxes, you're paying sales taxes, you're paying all sorts of other taxes that take a bigger bite out of your paycheck than they do out of people who are earning 3, 4, 5, 10 times, 500 times more than you're paying. And we need a tax system that is equitable, that is fair, that calls for equal sacrifice. And I think that's why a vast majority of Americans right now, unlike previous generations, are saying to pollsters, yes, the rich should pay their fair share. They really owe it to the country. This is a matter of fairness. It's a matter of patriotism. We, the middle class, the working class, the poor, we cannot bear the burden. We are already flat on our backs.
And so what has to give for that to happen? Because if you hold it true that you have to increase tax revenue or you will not be able to deal with deficit reduction, what's ahead? Nothing? I mean, things getting worse?
Well, we have two big problems in the economy right now. The biggest problem is jobs and growth. In fact, let me expand that a little bit more accurately, jobs, wages, and growth. We could create a lot of jobs if everybody's wage went down to a nickel an hour, but obviously that's absurd. That's not the goal. So it's jobs, wages, and growth. That's the most important immediate problem. In the out years, that is 10 years from now, we have got to, and before we get to that 10-year point, we've got to also do something about the debt, the national debt, or the yearly deficit that keeps on mounting. Now, to do both at the same time is a little bit difficult. The obvious sequence would be to do something first about jobs and growth and wages, and then once we get the economy moving again and get people back with jobs and good jobs, paying a decent wage, then move on to do something about the debt and the deficit when we have more revenues coming in, when growth is restored, when the debt as a proportion of total economy starts shrinking. And so what the president is trying to do is both. He last week presented a jobs plan. We've talked about that. It could have been bigger and more ambitious, but he did. And then he yesterday presented his deficit reduction plan. Again, I think he drew a line in the sand very clearly. The debate now is going to be about whether the rich should pay more taxes or not. And I guess I was surprised at how and pleased at how strongly the president came down on that one particular issue. Mm. And that we've got to be we're going to be debating both. Most Americans, they desperately need jobs and good wages, and they should not, must not be asked to pay more taxes. The very wealthy, they are doing better than they've ever done before, ever in our history. The only time that they've done as well is the Roaring Twenties. But they've never paid as low a tax rate and be doing as well. And I suppose you could say comparably the Roaring Twenties, but if you look closely at the tax rates of the Roaring Twenties, you see people at the top actually did pay a little bit more than they're paying right now. And we've got to do both at the same time, or at least we've got to get on with both tasks, Kathleen. And average working people simply are in a terribly, terribly difficult position today. Is really the only comparable time we've had in this country is the Great Depression. People are not in that terrible a state, but we've not been this stressed as a nation economically since the Great Depression. Most people have not even come out of the Great Recession. We talk about this as a recovery, but most Americans are still finding that their jobs, wages, their benefits are still hugely stressed by what's going on.
Yes, they are. We will welcome more phone calls in a moment. Former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich is our guest this half hour of the program. We, of course, are talking about the president's deficit reduction plan, which he announced yesterday, and welcoming your thoughts on it. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Lehrer joins us the second hour of our program today. He's written a really interesting book, Tension City, Inside the Presidential Debates from Kennedy, Nixon to Obama, McCain, My View from the Middle Seat. He has moderated 11 of those debates, and they're fascinating stories. He also asked the participants in the debates to give their thoughts, their reflections on what they had been through, and he talked with most of the major participants. So, Jim Lehrer with us, hour number two. Former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich is our guest now. John in Green Bay is our next caller. Hi, John.
Good Good morning. Good morning. I just wanted to comment on the talking point that 50% of Americans don't pay any taxes, federal income taxes. 27% of the total, which would be 27 out of 100, I believe are on Social Security or Social Security disability. So, I mean, they are the poorest of the poor, so to speak, considering whether they're retired or not. I believe average Social Security payments to date are about $1,500 a month, and if that's your only income and your average, then you've got to pay your Medicare and everything and live off of that. And I also think a lot of people don't understand that Social Security is actually capped, and that once, I believe it's right about $108,000, you get, if you're so lucky to make that kind of money, I believe you get about a 7% tax cut. In other words, a person making $208,000 will pick up another $7,500 a month. So I just think that, you know, we've got to look towards, you know, some empathy towards some of these people and just not use the talking points. That's my comment.
Thank you very much, John.
Well, John, you know, empathy is the word. We're sort of losing it as a society. I mean, the people who charge that half Americans don't pay income taxes, not only are they not looking closely at who those are, but they also are losing sight of the fact that income taxes are only one of many sources of taxation. And those Americans who are so poor that they don't pay income taxes, they do if they are working. They pay Social Security taxes. In most states, they pay sales taxes. They pay property taxes indirectly, even if they're renting. And all of those taxes do take a larger bite out of their paychecks than they do out of somebody who's very wealthy. Because somebody who's wealthy satisfies, for example, as you said, John, their Social Security obligations once they hit, and it's right now at about $106,800. So if you are making, if you're in the top income group, if you're making over $1 million a year, you're going to satisfy your Social Security obligations very, very quickly, and you're not going to pay any Social Security taxes over $106,800, whereas most of us pay Social Security taxes on our entire income. That's an example. The canard, the charge that 50% of people are not paying income taxes, and therefore they ought to be taxed. I mean, can you imagine the absurdity of that? Given the totality of taxation in this country, and also given that the very rich are paying so little. They're using capital gains, which is now taxed at 15%, to lower their tax burden at the federal level. So, for example, as Warren Buffett said the other day, Warren Buffett's the second richest man in America, he was confessing and being concerned about, and kudos to Warren Buffett for leading the charge on this, that he's paying about 17% of his income in taxes, which is less, he says, than his secretary was paying. Here again, we've got to have a tax system that is fair. Otherwise, most of us just become cynical, we become distrustful, and when it comes to paying for the public services we depend on, including national defense, mind you, the tax burden is going to go up on the rest of us.
What did you think of the president's vowing to veto any deficit reduction that cuts benefits to Medicare but doesn't raise taxes on wealthy and big corporations?
I was very pleased, Kathleen, that he drew that sharp a kind of line in the sand, that he laid down the gauntlet in that very definitive way. I mean, too often, I think, this president has been a little bit wishy-washy. He has started bargaining really from a position where he's given away too much right at the start. And the other side has not come any way at all. In fact, often they say no, and they don't even budge. So for him to say, I'm going to veto that bill that comes to me, that super committee bill, unless it has, if it does cut Medicare at all, Medicare or Medicaid, unless it increases taxes on the rich, I think does signal his willingness to finally be tough about a matter that deserves that kind of toughness.
You have to wonder why he wasn't tough a long time ago.
Well, I do wonder that. I think, you know, he's, you know, we don't want to get too much into personal psychology, and I'm not qualified. But I would say that he came to the office as a conciliator. I mean, he really did believe, wrongly it turned out, that everyone would see the light. Eventually he could get a consensus on everything from health care to the first stimulus to financial reform to whatever was before him. And it turned out that he could not, because again and again, the other side of the aisle would simply say no. Even after, you know, I expected him to stop this conciliation stuff after Mitch McConnell, the head of the Senate, Republican, head of the Republicans in the Senate, said so openly that their number one objective after 2010, their number one objective wasn't to improve the economy, to get jobs back, to...
We have about 5 seconds.
Osama bin Laden. Their number one objective was to get rid of and unseat from his presidency.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye. Thank you, Robert Reich, very much for being with us. He's ready for his day to start in California. Thanks, former Secretary of Labor. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour.
Support for WPR comes from Steep & Brew, offering Cafe Fair brand coffees. Organic, fair-traded, and shade-grown coffees in yellow Cafe Fair packaging, available at local grocers and co-ops. Cafe Fair Coffee, socially responsible coffee in the yellow bags.
Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. We all know that how we spend our money matters. As a Marketplace listener, you also know that when you spend money often matters, too. So please consider Wisconsin Public Radio's Half the Time Pledge Drive. Contribute now before the fall pledge drive, and you'll help make it a success in 6 days instead of the usual 12. Give early. It's good advice. Call 888-202-2889 to give now, and thanks.